Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is a People's Archive of the Bay Area. I'm going to start us off with a poem by Robert Deneuz, a member of the French Resistance. You who are living, what have you done with these treasures? Do you regret the time of my struggle? Have you raised your crops for a common harvest? Have you made my town a richer place? When we think of history, what is it? Who makes it or makes it up? And whose job is it to brush history against the grain? To the extent that what matters is in the contemporary world is often secured through reference to the past. Who are the critical thinkers and creators of the Bay Area's cultural and historical narratives? What is the relationship between the past and the present in the Bay Area? Joining me in studio as we ask these questions and explore the dominant and hidden narratives, both past and present of the Bay Area's communities are Chris Carlson, a writer, San Francisco historian, professor, bicyclist, tour guide, blogger, and photographer. Chris, now a 35-year resident of San Francisco, has written two books and edited six, including Nowtopia, Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration, and 10 Years That Shook the City, San Francisco, 1968 to 1978. He is co-founder of Critical Mass, has directed Shaping San Francisco since the mid-1990s, and also co-directs the Archive of San Francisco History at foundsf.org. Chris conducts award-winning bicycle tours, his bicycle history tours, and walking tours, and hosts a public talk series in San Francisco. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We also have Susan Goldstein. She has served as the city archivist of San Francisco for 16 years, documenting the city's history at the San Francisco History Center at the San Francisco Public Library. Susan has worked as the archivist to Senator Alan Cranston for 3 years, serving on his staff in California and Washington, D.C. And she's also been a community organizer who has worked at the Labor Archives and Research Center at San Francisco State University, collecting labor union history also. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And last, by phone, we have David Hilliard. And David is the executive director of the Intercommunal Institute for Research and Social Change and the founding member and former chief of staff in the Black Panther Party. And he formed the Dr. Huey P. Newton Foundation, a nonprofit center focusing on research, education, and advocacy for social change. And he's the author of The Side of Glory, a personal narrative and account of the Black Panthers that claims a long obscured and almost lost piece of history, and the co-author of the first authorized biography about Newton. And he frequently lectures on African-American resistance movements and also conducts Black Panther bus tours. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or emailing us at feedback@cityvisions.com. And we'll start taking phone calls at about 7:20, 7:30. So this is a very interesting topic, the history of San Francisco, but looking at it from different angles and from the People's Archive. Let me start out with you, Chris Carlson. You're a writer and a San Francisco historian, and you've described the motto of Shaping San Francisco as, quote, a history, as history is a creative act in the present. Can you explain this further?
Sure. I think it's really important to imagine, you know, one of the things you brought up, the point that we have this sort of relationship to the concept of history in our society, and what unfortunately that involves is people use it as an epithet as often as not to say that you're irrelevant. Ah, you're history, pal. And so that's really kind of, you know, galling to me as somebody who's been concerned for a very long time of trying to really connect the stories that lead us to the point we're in today, because people tend to think history is irrelevant. That is really a common American attitude. So, you know, if you start thinking about the deeper story, which is how did the world get like this? There's so many different ways it could be. And when you start unpacking those threads and all the different antecedents that got us to this moment, you realize how many times it's the actual activities of individual human beings working in cohort with each other, intervening in social moments, you know, social struggles, riots, strikes. I mean, so many different things that people express themselves, culture, art, et cetera. And so all those kinds of activities that people engage in every day are part of what makes history. And then the discovery of history itself, the sort of ascertaining what's meaningful about history, is something we do together. It's not something that's just a pile of dusty facts behind us. It's actually an active process of actual discussion, argument, trying to unpack, you know, well, where did you get that information? Why do you think that? What's your pre-assumptions that led you to believe those ideas? What are you basing them on? And so you're forced to think creatively about how you understand the past, which, of course, in very strongly influences what you think of the present. And ultimately, if you start to understand how much we can influence the way we frame our understanding of the past and the present, we then start to open up the door for an interesting conversation about how we might have a different path out of this mess we're in for the future.
Well, I mean, do you think that, in your opinion, is something not really history until it's been written down?
Well, that's one of the ongoing arguments in the field of history. There's plenty of sort of stodgier old historians, all of whom will be really angry and call up now, that think it's only true if it was written down. It's only if you can find documentary evidence that something could be true. And so much of what's come from this new history from below, which is not so new anymore, it's many decades old, but a real emergence in the 20th century of a different way of thinking about history and recognizing how many sources of history are systematically silenced by that insistence on things having had to have been written down. Because, first of all, large parts of the world population are not literate. Secondly, many of the languages in which history has been written were not the languages of everyday people. There's a really beautiful book by a Haitian scholar named Michel Rolf Trouillot called Silencing the Past. And it's really one of the great history books of the last 25 years, in which he really lays out sort of the history of the Haitian Revolution. And he wrote the first history of the Haitian Revolution in the Haitian language, which had never been done. All the history of Haiti and the Haitian Revolution, which is the greatest slave revolt in history, the first successful one, in fact, that, you know, totally overthrew white rule and European rule in the Caribbean. Very influential in United States history, very influential in world history, but blacked out completely. We don't know about it. Americans right. don't even have a clue. And part of the reason is because the way that history was told was mostly in French.
Well, let me ask you. So you wrote a book. You wrote a couple of books, but your book about San Francisco. Did you feel a lot of responsibility in terms of, you know, if this is going to be people, this is going to be one way of people remembering what happened in San Francisco? Did you...
Well, what I've done is there's three books, all of them, we call them Reclaiming San Francisco books. The first one was called Reclaiming San Francisco, History, Politics, and Culture. All three are published by City Lights. The other two are The Political Edge and the one you mentioned, 10 Years That Shook the City.
Uh-huh.
All of them are anthologies. Uh-huh. And so they're based on multiple voices. And this is really sort of the theoretical and methodological approach that I prefer towards history, which is that there's not just one truth. There are many points of view, and it's going back to this point about history being a creative act in the present. To understand what the truth is of the past is something that you have to actively engage in with your mind and your creative thinking and your own assumptions and your own political ideas, and that's going to shape your sense of truth. And that's just true, and this doesn't mean that there's only one story that's the one that's going to trump all the other ones. I mean, there's some things that are yes or no, that happened or it didn't happen. But as we create a complex vision of life as we know it, you can only really get that from multiple voices, multiple points of view. And the less you have that, the less, I think, close you are to a proper and true understanding of history. True, I always have to put in quotes.
Well, let me bring Susan into this conversation. So you are the archivist at the San Francisco Library. And how do you make decisions about what to accept and what to, you know, what to keep in the archives?
So we are the archives for the city and county of San Francisco, and we are located in the library up on the sixth floor. And it's hard. You know, the job is to document the city. So what does that mean to document a city? You know, the political life, the social life, the cultural life, ethnic communities in the city. And we're kind of collecting the raw stuff. And people come in and they get the stuff and they use it for all different kinds of projects. And people sometimes will use one source for completely different reasons, completely different ways, sometimes opposing ways. So we're always making decisions.
What do you mean by raw source?
Well, we get a lot of records from city departments. That's part of what we do. We get the mayor's papers. We get papers from city departments. So Right now we have some police department records that one of the archivists on staff is working on. Very interesting. They go back to the 1800s. But part of that are the records from the HUAC hearings in 1960, when a lot of people were arrested and hosed down the stairs. So that's kind of some of the raw stuff. And just kind of tying into what Chris was talking about, we're also working with the people involved with the 50th anniversary of HUAC, the people who are the protesters, and we're going to get their oral histories and their accounts. So I think for us, it's also collecting a multiplicity of voices when we can. But sometimes we just have ledgers. Sometimes we have the records of the SPCA, the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, started in the 1880s here. Incredible ledgers, you know, that go back, talking about people whipping their horses in the park or breaking up cockfighting. And, you know, a lot of academics are using that collection right now to look at progressive era reforms. So that's kind of an example of some of the raw stuff.
Well, now, do you can you go back and reclaim things, the raw stuff from, you know, the Chinese perspective in terms of building the railroads? Or you really, is that kind of challenging because of their role and what they were able to write down, communicate?
Right. So there's always gaps in the historical record, and there's always underdocumented communities. And I think one of the parts of my job is to try and get at those the best I can. So some of the stuff comes to us very passive, city records come in. Other stuff, and this is where I think being an archivist is like being a community organizer, you have to go out into the community and talk to people and see people's records and see if people have things to fill in the gaps in the story. So sometimes it's very active. One of the things we do, we haven't done one in a while, is we have photo collecting days where we go into different communities and we have them bring in family photos and we make a copy for the archives and we have them talk about it. And the reason we did it is because ethnic communities here were so underdocumented visually. So that's been a really strong project for us. And those have been used many, many times since we've done the project.
Well, very, very interesting. We're going to get back to this.
Yeah.
Let me bring in David Hilliard. So you are a lot of things now, but in terms of history, you were one of the founders of the Black Panthers, and very misunderstood. Do you feel like I've heard misunderstood in terms of what they were or their, you know, role in history? Is that correct?
Well, yes, we've been frozen into this imagery of guys marching to the state capitol, protesting gun laws and confrontation with the police, especially in the local area of Oakland, California. And the Huey Newton Foundation was created to give a much more expansive and relevant definition of our Black Panther Party, bringing into account why we existed in the first place. Underwrote by an economic development program called our 10-point program that called for economic development, decent housing, free health care, not universal health care, free, and education that gave us a sense of our history. And you know, those 10 points sort of highlighted that. So we created the Huey Newton Foundation in that spirit, to try to track and to give our Black Panther Party that's been frozen in that narrow context of being these young kids with guns and just, you know, slogans of all power to the people. We were much more than that, to the extent that we were in some 8 foreign countries we call communities, because America is an empire, so they're really not nations, they're communities. We had some 30, 48 chapters here in America. So we were very impactful, very large, and very important piece of American history that's pretty much been, you know, written out and pigeonholed. And the emphasis of the Huey Newton Foundation is to bring all that into the public consciousness.
How successful do you think it's been?
Well, if you take into account that right now, you know, this President Obama is talking about universal health care, well, that's our 6 points of our 10-point program, calling not for universal health care, but free health care. We initiated free breakfast for children programs in California and then throughout America. Until many years later, there's not a school in America that does not have hot, nutritious breakfast for children. We also implemented a program called Sickle Cell Anemia Research Foundation. It's called SAFE, and Bussing to Senior programs. So there was just numerous survival programs that we implemented that are now pretty much the order of the day. So I think in that context, we were very effective.
What about in the context of changing the perception? I mean, clearly you've done some fantastic things. Do you feel like in terms of having current generations understand what, or in past, of the whole breadth of what the Black Panther Party did has been successful, or do you think that it's really hard to change the historical perception as opposed to really what's happening in history?
Well, of course, because we're still up against the most powerful medium in the entire universe. This is the United States of America that controls Hollywood, every television station, all of the printed words, be it the New York Times or the San Francisco Chronicle. So we certainly, they pretty much have pigeonholed us with these young kids marching around the courthouse with slogans about Free Huey and police attacks. There's never any focus given to the work that I just outlined, at the opening of our statement. We were so much more than that. When we started in 66, we had a 10-point program, and we were always trying to realize that, and that's what's been left out. So we're still up against, this imagery of being militants with slogans and no other virtue that will give people a real definite accounting of what our movement was all about.
So Susan, let me go back to Susan. I mean, when you know there's an organization like this, a party like this, that has this public, the media's kind of picked up on one image, and yet there's so much more to it. Is that, do you try to take into account that and make sure that there's archives, not just news archives, which talk
right.
about the militant side of things?
Right. I mean, ideally, we would collect the personal papers of somebody or people who were in the movement, letters going back and forth, minutes of meetings, things like that. What I wanted to ask David, what I thought was so interesting, was the article today that Richard Aoki was named as an informant with the Black Panthers. And I thought, that was a case of history just erupting this morning, mm-hmm. And having some new information. Thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, did you have a response to that? Did you see that, David?
I did. And, just for history's sake, to set the record straight, Richard Aoki was not a member of the Black Panther Party. He was a supporter of the Black Panther Party. He supplied some of the original first guns to our organization when we were doing the early patrols and protesting our constitutional right to carry guns, to bear arms, which should have never been anything about that. Because if you fast forward here, these white men show up at the president's rally, armed to the gills, and nothing is being done about that. We were doing it in the same context under the same constitution. So Richard was not in the party. He was a student at UC Berkeley, and he supplied the Black Panther Party with some initial guns during the early nascent stages of our party when we were called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
Okay. Let me take a comment from Chris.
Yeah, I just wanted to really emphasize, I think David made it pretty clear that it's one of the great problems of relying on official sources is that you have a very hard time reclaiming the narrative of your own history. And this was a big motivation for us to start our project, Shaping San Francisco, back in the 90s. It came out of an experience I had where I was walking down the street about 3 months after the big Gulf War protests of 91, which had been 150,000 people marching down the streets. And then soon after that, we were walking down the street, and a guy says to me, he says, there hasn't been an anti-war movement here since Vietnam. Well, guess what? You were walking next to me 3 months ago in a march of 100,000 people. So when we don't see our own stories and our own experiences properly represented, it's easy to forget our own lived experience. And so I think, creating the records, creating a way of actually communicating with each other about our real lived experiences and lived history is very essential, because right now we're stuck with having to fight against the false narratives of the New York Times and the Chronicle and everybody else.
Sure. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're having kind of a people's archive of San Francisco and talking about history and what makes San Francisco's history. My guests are Chris Carlson, San Francisco historian, tour guide, and co-founder of Critical Mass, Susan Goldstein, the city archivist of San Francisco at the San Francisco Public Library, and David Hilliard, a founding member of the Black Panther Party and currently with the Food and Justice Coalition. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call and join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Do you have any questions about San Francisco's history? Do you have any questions about how things have been documented? Please give us a call. 415-841-4134. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, even as, you know, I think talking to David, we get like the tip of the iceberg in terms of misnomers of San Francisco or Bay Area. I'd love to hear a little more about things that maybe people think are real in the Bay Area but aren't the whole story. Susan, have you come across stories like this or situations?
Well, the one we get most often is the underground opium dens in Chinatown. I think that's what people want to know about the most often. And I'm not really, I mean, it's not to the extent that people think it is. I think there's whole books on it. But it
for those people that don't know, can you tell a little bit?
Oh, you know, people believe that in the 19th century, there was an extensive underground network. I think there was some kind of underground tunnels in Chinatown, but and they were all peopled by opium dens. And we do have an opium pipe in the collection. I mean, you know, some of that is true. But I would say that's the question we get most often. I think there's a lot of contested history in the Bay Area. And again, people look at the same documents and draw completely different interpretations. I mean, you know, that's how it is. And it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Chris?
Well, there's so many different things that you could go to, but one of the thing that leaps to my mind that I'm always trying to get across in the various tours and other ways that I present history locally is about the landscape here. People tend to think that San Francisco's landscape is what it always was. And like, for instance, they think Golden Gate Park was somehow a natural place that was full of trees and grass like it is today, and that the south of Market and downtown have always been relatively flat. And none of that's true. I mean, San Francisco was full of very tall sand dunes, and it took a huge human effort using what was derogatorily referred to as steam paddies at the time, steam shovels, to flatten all those hills and put it into all the water and wetlands and creeks and the bay itself, which is only one-third of its original size. So actually the kind of way that we receive our sense of history often is from the physical landscape we're in, and we tend to think of that as somewhat timeless and permanent, and it's actually quite alterable and quite altered, in fact. The world we're in today is nothing like the one that was first met by the Europeans as they arrived. Obviously, first peoples were here way before us, and most of them were slaughtered in a horrible genocide. So.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, you know, a lot of times people think San Francisco was always a very progressive, open, welcoming community. Yeah. And, you know, that's not true at all. People really had a fight here for civil rights. There were, you know, sit-ins on Auto Row in the 1960s because they wouldn't hire African Americans. And we have in the collection exclusion clauses. You couldn't live in certain neighborhoods if you were Chinese or African American or Jewish. So it's shocking to people when they see these things. They can't believe this is San Francisco.
Yeah, Willie Mays came in 1958 and couldn't buy a house in Forest Hill at the time because there were racially restrictive covenants on the properties up there in the
hills.
Yes,
but was it still one of the more progressive cities? I mean, did things change here more quickly than the rest of the United States?
No, it had pockets, you know, of progressive kind of bohemia, but ways
it's always been culturally progressive, but the fact is that the old money, the people that got here first and set up the walls and said, we're going to keep owning this place as long as possible, many of them still do. And the best source for that is Gray Brecken's history, the really brilliant book that he wrote called Imperial San Francisco. But, you know, the fact is that it's been a city run by old white people.
I mean,
it's
a complicated story because it's always been a strong union town. But the unions often were racist, but it had very strong union labor.
Super racist in the 19th century.
It's very complicated.
So I don't mean
David.
Be, you know, just officious in any way, but let's talk a little bit about lessons from the 60s and 70s for today's leaders. And under that rubric, the Huey Newton Foundation, or the Intercommunal Institute for Research and Social Change, and the Coalition for Food Justice, we're hosting an event Saturday, August 25th, at the Empress Theater here in Vallejo, so people can come and get lessons. How we were able to be such an effective organization so that this generation can carry the banner forward and do some of the stuff that that's left undone, and they're going to have to do it. So we're inviting everybody within the earshot of this program to come to our Survival Pending Transformation of Society Forum at the Empress Theater in Vallejo at 330 Virginia Street between 6 and 9.
You bring up thank you for that, and you can tell people again at the end if they missed it. We can also post that on our website. I want to kind of play off something you just said, David. But you talk about like the current generations, and are there and lessons? So are there less specific lessons that you can talk about right now that you feel that this generation has missed out on because maybe their sense of history or lack of sense of history?
Well, I think more pertinent, more. I should say imminent is the fact that I watch and participate. I'm still showing up as recently as maybe a few months ago with the Occupy movement. And I noticed that there are not very many people of color involved in that Occupy, you know, phenomenon. I think that it's absolutely necessary. I know that it is. For young people to get involved, especially people of color. That's one of the reasons why we're holding this forum, to talk about why the Black Panther Party was so effective. And it was because we had coalitions with the Peace and Freedom Party. And in 1969, we were already in coalition with the gay rights movement. And we were in coalition with Cesar Chavez's farm workers, the Brown Berets, and the Young Lords, and for the Puerto Ricans in New York and Chicago. So there's a need for these minority groups to come together with this Occupy movement, with an agenda that's going to deal with the very basic desires and needs like jobs, like housing, like health care, and begin to make some real substantial changes in this system. So we're going to talk a lot about that at the Survivor Pending Transformation of Society Forum on Saturday, August 25th, and they're all invited to come and get lessons from
The
60s and 70s.
Well, Chris, in your book, you talk a lot about the 60s and 70s. Did you touch upon these racial groups
just going to give you a little quick pitch for one of the articles in our book by Dr. Jason Ferreira, who teaches out at San Francisco State. He wrote an article in here called With the Soul of a Human Rainbow, Los Siete, the Black Panthers and Third Worldism in San Francisco, which he does a really beautiful job of describing how third worldism was a lively and kind of forward-moving identitarian way of framing things. And it wasn't just about, you know, having this kind of balkanized identity where, you know, your group has got to be asserted against every other group. Instead, it was, as David was just pointing out, it was fundamentally coalitional. People saw themselves as building a third world identity out of a shared experience of what we were referring to earlier as a white racist San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Even in the 60s, it was well seen by folks who weren't part of that culture, that this town was not favorable if you were not in the white population. You were really had a hard time getting jobs. You had a hard time finding educational opportunities, housing, reasonable living standards were not available. So people came together, and they had a shared experience on the buses. They had a shared experience in the schools. Mm-hmm. They had a shared experience in the employment marketplace. And this article does a great job of bringing that out. And there's a nice quote from him on our website at foundsf.org. If the people go and take the 10 years that shook the city tour, they can hear all the authors reading excerpts from their articles.
Excellent. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're talking about history, San Francisco's history, and getting an analysis and more from three wonderful people that have been immersed in the history. My guests are Chris Carlson, San Francisco historian, tour guide, and co-founder of Critical Mass, Susan Goldstein, the city archivist of San Francisco at the San Francisco Public Library, and David Hilliard, a founding member of the Black Panther Party and currently with the Food and Justice Coalition. And we invite you to call in with your questions, your comments. The number to call and join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Call in with your questions about San Francisco's history. Call in with questions you've always wanted to know. And also any thoughts you have about maybe the current generation's understanding of what really happened or interest in it. We want to hear from you. Again, the number to call is 415-841-4134. And I do want to take some of our calls. We have several people. The first is we have Michael from Palo Alto. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening. I had a question about the crime and poverty and drug problems in the Tenderloin. And I was wondering if your guest could speak to the historical reason for why they seem to be intractable.
Okay. That's a great question. Now, is that something you've kind of heard, you always wondered about or heard about?
It's something that I'd you know, certainly heard about, but it's something that you can't help but see anytime you, you know, wander through that neighborhood. And I was just curious, you know, what has led to this?
Okay. Susan, are there any archives about that?
You know, it's interesting. We are collecting information on the Tenderloin. A lot of it's about the built environment and, a lot of the wonderful buildings that are there. It was just declared a historic district, and we have all those documents. And there were things, beautiful apartment houses that are still there, recording studios, businesses. So the neighborhood has changed over the years. It wasn't always the way it was now. It has changed over time. And also a theater group just did a piece on the Tenderloin, interviewing people and acting it out, and we've collected those scripts. As far as historically, I mean, I think there were other bad parts of the city. South of Market used to be a really dangerous, scary part of the city. Maybe some people still think it is. I think those have changed over time. I also, just from current experience, see the Tenderloin changing right before my eyes right now with mid-market development and new businesses moving in. But, yeah.
I mean, the Tenderloin, I actually had the interesting experience of publishing or helping to publish, because I was the typesetter for it, the Tenderloin Times, which was a newspaper that emerged from the social service agencies north of Market in the Tenderloin during the early 80s. And it had a lot to do with helping people identify themselves as part of a neighborhood. And those are the people who actually had a stake in it as a neighborhood and were trying to make it something better. And so you had a huge component of that was the influx of Southeast Asian refugees from the Vietnam War. You had all the people that had been living there in residential hotels but had been shunted aside as sort of, you know, throwaway people. And those folks put together the program that led to the center, heart of the city, Farmers Market. This is one of the most amazing farmers markets in the area, which in turn has fueled the rise of farmers markets all over San Francisco and really all over the Bay Area, and has had a lot to do with changing our food politics. So the Tenderloin has been actually a source of creativity and urban renewal on its own terms, as opposed to the kind that comes in from above, bulldozes the neighborhood, throws all the poor people out, and then says, okay, now we're going to rebuild it on a different model. Of course, it's under incredible pressure. As a central city neighborhood with a fine architectural stock, as Susan points out, people with money now have identified that, and they're moving in a big way. And so there's been an ongoing fight about the transition of residential hotels into tourist hotels. There's an ongoing fight to preserve the possibility of living poor in the city. Not that anybody wants to be poor or should be, but there are people who are.
And David, do you have any other thought? Do you have any thoughts on this, too? David Hilliard?
Well,
on the Tenderloin?
No, I think that the Tenderloin is downtown Oakland, and every other demographic in America is going through, you know, transition where, you know, developers are coming in and claiming the property and putting people in the hovels or back in the street or in tents. So, you know, just not a phenomenon that's a particular particular event in San Francisco. It's all over America.
Yeah.
But I'd just like to get back to the point of trying to get people involved in something where they can fight back in an effective way. And I think one of the things that can be done is to come to our Survival Pendant Transformation of Society Forum, Lessons from the 60s and 70s. That's going to be held at the Empress Theater here in Vallejo. You can call 510-547-1547 to get tickets, sponsored tickets to come to the event, and we can have discussions on what can be done. I think that we certainly have some answers to how people can take back communities and do something to deal with the real estate industry coming in and uprooting people and sending them to tents and stuff like that within the various cities.
Okay. Let me go back to Susan.
The city also made a choice at one point to concentrate social service agencies in the Tenderloin. So a lot of people are released from programs into the Tenderloin, and that's a lot of what has created the Tenderloin as
that
we
makes
know
sense.
It.
The other piece of that story was BART being built down Market Street, which had the effect of destroying a whole shopping district in the middle of Market Street that once brought the whole population of the city into the center of the
city. So it wasn't just one thing, clearly.
No, a number of different things overlap.
Michael, thank you for that call. Let me go to Philip. Good evening, Philip.
Hi, thank you.
You're from Brisbane.
Yes. When I think back on all these phenomenal changes and movements in San Francisco especially, but in the surrounding area too, I just wish that, you know, since there's no such thing as a time machine, there should be a great archival record of every year or at least every 5 years. And I was wondering, is there a central archival photographic site or something like that?
Yeah, good question.
Know?
Good question. Susan?
We have a very large photo archives of the city, and we have about 40,000 images online. And I know a lot of people use them, including Chris.
Quite often.
Found San Francisco, which is great. So we have probably pictures from almost every year of the city, and you should go to our website, sfpl.org, and click on the photo archive. And we have more that aren't digitized, but again, 40,000 that are. We'll get you started.
It's hours of fun. Yeah, and our site, FoundSF. .org is not only thousands of photographs, including a great number of the ones from the library, but also plenty of contemporary shots and then a lot more historical context. There's a lot of essays, and we also have a number of audio and video interviews with people who lived through these things and put them together into sort of a more complex multimedia presentation.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. You talk like photographs as being one angle, and another way of carrying on history in terms of, you know, having it available are these tours. Now, mm-hmm. you, Chris, and David give tours.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, tell me about, like, in terms of the tours that you give the walking and biking tours. Who looks at the content that you're telling people? Is there
vetted?
Yeah, is there someone? Or, you know, are these people walking away with whatever you want to tell them?
Pretty much, yeah. That's it. I'm in charge. I can make up the stories that I want to tell.
You have to keep an eye on him.
I often tell people that it's a little bit, you know, if you do to a lot of oral presentations, it's like a game of telephone. Stories drift. And so one of the interesting things about historiography, understanding how history is framed and constructed and shared, is that stories move on their own. Even though you think you're telling the same story you've always told, you've suddenly something added came from a different story into that one by accident. You didn't do it on purpose, but it happens. So I warn people about that at the start of my tours. I say, you know, I've told these stories a lot of times, and you know, here's the bibliography. We publish it on the itinerary that we give people, and say, please, if you wonder about it, check it out, because I admit that sometimes things will drift, and you know, it's really worth trying to follow up on that if you're concerned.
So what sort of things do you tell people, and how do you decide to talk about the things you talk about?
Well, I'm interested in the kind of comedy. I'm particularly interested in the connection between labor history and ecological history, because uh-huh. those two things very rarely come out of one person's mouth in the same half hour. You know, people interested in labor history want to talk about work, they want to talk about unions, they want to talk about industrial history, all these different things, but they don't really want to talk about the mess that's been made.
Mm.
And then people interested in ecological politics generally end up thinking about, well, write a check on Sunday afternoon and get a calendar and a tote bag and that's, you're done, you know. And it's like, no, actually the work we're doing is making the mess. And if you look at that historically, you start unfolding all these interesting topics, you know, and interesting ways of seeing the physical environment in front of us. So, you know, I mean, there's an interesting story, for instance, about Chinese shrimping villages that used to exist around the edge of the bay.
Tell us about
with
that.
With 30, something like, the number I really don't remember right now, so you'll have to look it up online, but I think it was around 3 million pounds of shrimp were still being harvested out of the bay in the early 1930s by only about 70 small companies with about 180 workers, all Chinese workers in these little villages. Well, that, you know, no longer is possible. There's no more shrimp in the bay. And that's just a tiny example of the kind of way we might have had a very different relationship with our physical environment, both from the point of view of working it and eating it, than the one that we actually have. And one of the interesting sort of outcomes of this new awareness of the sort of histories of food and histories of the sort of physical environment is that a lot of people are really excited about reanimating and re-inhabiting the physical natural environment of urban life. And so you have this growth of, you know, urban farming and community gardening. You have this Friends of the Urban Forest has planted tens of thousands of trees throughout San Francisco. You have a greener city today than ever. So when you look at old photos, even just as recently as the 1960s, San Francisco's cement, mm-hmm. as far as the eye can see. And today, it's quite a dense forested city, and the backyards are full of food growing and fruit trees, and many more species are coming back to San Francisco life. So there's a way in which we're starting to recalibrate ourselves in terms of the logic of natural systems as urban dwellers. And I think that has a lot to do with understanding what the history of the natural systems were here first. And that's a lot of what I try to do on my tours.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions on KLW and KLW.org. Tonight we're discussing the San Francisco history from the history as from three people, three archivists, if you will, one official and two self-proclaimed. We have Chris Carlson, a San Francisco historian, tour guide, and co-founder of Critical Mass. Susan Goldstein, a city archivist of San Francisco at the San Francisco Public Library. And David Hilliard, a founding member of the Black Panther Party and currently with the Food and Justice Coalition.
Well, actually, we're in coalition with the Food and Justice Coalition, no doubt, but we're the Intercommunal Institute for Research and Social Change.
Okay.
It is a project of the Dr. UEP Newton Foundation, and I also do Black Panther legacy tours that have appeared in Asahi Graph, which is equivalent to Time Magazine in Japan. I've been in the Washington Post, the New York Times. I've done CNN. I've done all of the major networks. We've been around since, I believe, 1996. I do 18 sites in the history of our Black Panther Party. And the tours are still very much visited when you come to Oakland.
So tell me who?
Let me just finish. Oakland was only known when we traveled, be it New York or Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. They only knew about the Raiders. The Black Panther Party put Oakland on the map on a global level, as did the Raiders. And that's what these tours are about, to remind people of a more glorious time when we were working to empower not just Black folks or African Americans, but gays and Hispanics or Latin Americans, if you can, progressive working class whites. So that was a time when Oakland really represented more than 200 gang killings, as I think at this count.
David, that's wonderful. I'm really curious. Now, did you decide to do these tours independently, or did you in one of your groups decide this would be a good way to get information, disseminate information?
Well, it was me and Mrs. Newton, Frederica Newton, Huey Newton's widow, who created the Dr. Huey P. Newton Foundation, and we decided that in order to best, you know, keep our history in the forefront of the people who come to the city of Oakland, is to create these tours, because the Black Panther Party was so much about putting Oakland, you know, in somebody's consciousness that didn't live in this area in the early 60s and 70s. So it was out of that idea that we created the Black Panther Party legacy tours.
And what sort of questions do people ask you?
Well, they ask all kinds of questions. One is they want to go to the place where we did the first breakfast program. Of course, there are these people who seem to freeze us and lock us into the militancy and the radicalism of that era, so they want to know about where little Bobby Hutton was killed, and we go and stand in the place where little Bobby Hutton was killed. Or there's these people who have a more contemporary history who were reminded where Huey Newton was killed by a drug dealer down in West Oakland. We go there, and we talk about Huey Newton, who'd become addicted to drugs, and how he lost his life in the streets of Oakland after being such an inspiring model in trying to help raise, you know, our agenda, Black folks, that is, to a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't leave anything unturned. We deal with all of those issues, and we go to 19 sites in the city of Oakland in the history of our party.
Right.
And it's about 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions, and we're talking tonight about San Francisco history. If you would like to ask questions about the history or call in, email us. Basically, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to actually go to a different topic, and that's the whole digital era and how that's changed creating history and what is history. And I know, Chris, you mentioned sort of on the side of the history coming from below versus above. And, you know, I think about sites like Wikipedia, where basically anyone can come in and add something. And yet so many people look at it like it's the encyclopedia. So I don't know, Susan, maybe let me ask you first. I mean, how has the digital era changed?
Digital is huge for us. Digital makes it easier to disseminate history. You can get stuff out there to people. I think it's really significant in that way. And things like Chris's website or blogs that people are doing history on, there's great crowdsourcing on blogs like Mission Mission where people are all writing in about their neighborhoods. We're digitizing maps and photographs and texts and putting them out there for people. That's fantastic. My concern, which is a little different than what you're talking about, is that we're missing collecting digital material and that people are not as conscious about saving it and handing it in, or we're not getting drafts of material. We're just getting a final product after it's been digitized and perfect. So I am worried about historical gaps in the future. So we're taking both paper collections, but also we're trying to collect digital material.
And a shout out to the Internet Archive for trying to get a snapshot of the Internet every single day for a long time now. Doing very much as much as they possibly can do to gather that kind of digital information.
Well, that's really interesting that you say that, because I would think that, you know, they always warn you that, you know, anything you put on Facebook is there forever. I mean, it would seem like it would be easier at this time to get all the, you know, so much more and so much more anecdotal.
Some of it's technological. Like somebody will give us a collection and there'll be 5.5-inch floppies in it. You know, who has a machine to put those
or
on
an
anymore? You know, or, you know, so some of it is really a technological problem that is just continuing. And then also as we get digital material, especially digital photographs, digital images, we have to migrate it. It has to go to the next new technology, and that's just going faster and faster.
Yeah.
And that's expensive for us.
Yeah, we've had the same problem just in our project, Shaping San Francisco, going from original CD-ROMs. And
I
the
remember
public
that.
We had the public kiosk running at the main library where Susan works. For 10 years, and then eventually it went completely obsolete, and we had to get rid of it. And now, of course, the whole site's online. And you mentioned Wikipedia, Lauren, and, you know, Wikipedia is as accurate as any encyclopedia, according to all the objective measurements. They say, you know, it's true that you might want to double-check and triple-check things that you read in Wikipedia, but it's pretty reliable source at this point, given how many people are vetting it and checking each other and everything else. And our site, FoundSF, which is the Shaping San Francisco Collection at foundsf.org, we are open in the same way. We're using exactly the same software. We invite people to come in with their points of view and tell their stories and add it to the archive. We don't get as many people doing it as Wikipedia does. But slowly but surely, you gather more and more accounts. And it's from that multiplicity of accounts that you can really start to build a real sense of history. So our site does two things. It's not only a place where you can learn about history, it's a place where you can contribute raw material that then becomes the raw material for future historians as well. So it does both things at once.
Okay.
I just worry about what we're missing. You know, we have Harvey Milk's love letters in the collection. You know, do people write love letters to other people? I mean, it goes out on the internet, but I don't know that we collect that. I don't know that it maybe if it's on a Facebook page, but we're going to miss a lot of information. That's really interesting.
David?
I have a site called BlackPantherTrust.com. That is our intellectual, our information site. And what we plan to put there is some microfilm collection, which is about 67 reels. And the microfilm collection is the archival deposit that we have in Stanford University's Department of Special Collection. I have that stuff microfilmed. We're looking for the resources to upload that microfilm collection and put on this website.
Dave, I need to ask you. You're coming across a little choppy. Have you changed your phone?
What no,
you're
I'm on the same phone.
Okay.
So, but we have about 9 hours of recently discovered interviews from about Huey Newton with Gerd Stern, who came out of the era.
Okay.
The beatnik era with Fairleigh Getty and the people over at City Lights, and he taped Huey in 1976.
Wait, you know, David, I'm going to actually, our engineer is going to call you right back because there's something wrong with our line and you're not coming through and you're saying some important things. So,
okay.
So we'll call you right back. We'll come back to David in a second, but I do want to just ask about your feeling on the current generation, and do you think that the way they want to receive history has changed? Do you think that they're willing to go into archives, or do you think that they feel like they have to see everything as a documentary to get history? Susan?
I think that they think everything's online, and often it's not. And they want it to be online and it's easy, and there certainly is a lot. When they come in, they love it. They love to see the real thing. They love to hold the real Gold Rush Diary or the real scrapbook from the AIDS ward in the first days of the AIDS epidemic. It's incredibly moving for people. So I think they don't know that they want the real thing still, but they do. So it's both. Yeah.
I mean, the issues of attention span that we all talk about all the time nowadays, which is that, you know, we're all so busy. Everybody's so frantic. There's this constant speed up that we're living through, and nobody ever stops to say, wait a minute, we're all going to slow down now. Let's just go back to how it used to be when we could talk to each other calmly over a cup of coffee.
Right.
And, you know, to really understand history and get into it, you need a fairly large amount of time to read.
Uh-huh.
And there's not a lot of people that are either have the time or if they have it, that they're willing to dedicate it to reading. And so the idea that you can kind of get this quick fix on history, I think, is basically false. You do need to actually do a good deal of reading if you want to have personally a comprehensive sense of any part of history. And so, you know, websites are great places to start, but that's always been my vision, is that it's a way to get you enticed and involved and start thinking about it, and then you really do have to go further.
You know, I want to, since we have you here, Chris, I do want to talk about one very interesting part of San Francisco history, which is the critical mass.
Sure.
And maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the real story.
Well, critical mass starts starts 20 years ago, right? We're about to come right up to our 20th anniversary here at the end of September. So there's going to be an international festival going on for the whole week of September 22nd through September 30th. With the great 20th anniversary ride on the 28th of
September. Maybe tell people what exactly.
And critical mass, if you haven't encountered it at some point in your life, is a moment where all the people who ride bicycles on a daily basis, starting back in 1992 in September in San Francisco, decided to get together once a month and ride home together in a group. And by doing so, fill the streets with bikes and make so there was no room for cars and become the prevailing speed of traffic and change the feeling of being in the city. And it has a very euphoric and magical experience for everybody that participates in it. There's a sense of, you know, a different kind of city, a way of smelling it, hearing it, tasting it. You're rolling along the streets, listening to tinkling bells and talking to interesting people and having political and philosophical conversations. And it's been quite remarkable. And at this point, it's spread throughout the world. It's gone to over 400 cities around the world. We have a brand new book coming out that'll soon be in the public library called Shift Happens, Critical Mass at 20. And that'll be out in early September. And we have a bunch of flyers and posters that'll start hitting the town now in the near future. So critical mass is a very dynamic international movement, and it's very horizontalist. Like some of the official ideas of it is, and there's no official, to be honest, but the common embrace is the idea that there's no leaders, and everybody can communicate with zerocracy. Anybody can be a zerocrat. You can just put your stuff down on a piece of paper and hand it out to other bicyclists. And so this kind of way of spreading things horizontally actually had a big influence even on the Occupy movement, because many, many occupiers in all parts of the United States had an experience earlier of riding in a critical mass where there's nobody in charge and you have to figure it out in the heat of the moment with each other. And, you know, some people are angry with you. You have to talk to them and calm them down and invite them to join you next month. And
Do you think it's been misunderstood, you know, that it's changed?
Absolutely. No, the history of it has been badly distorted by its representation in the media. And most people have a very friendly and joyful experience. And most, if you think about it, it's gone on for 20 straight years. And there's been very few moments of conflict or hardship for anybody. And in general, it's a party. Most people experience it as a party.
Okay. And what about, Susan, what about you? Do you have any other stories in the last couple minutes that would be entertaining for listeners?
I don't know. I was just going to say there's an interesting bike history in San Francisco going way back, going through Golden Gate Park and other places involving women wearing their bloomers.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want to do a little more research on bike history, they should come by the archives and see what we have.
I mean, there were mass bike rides in San Francisco in the 1896 that had 5,000 to 8,000 bicyclists riding down the streets. And what were they demanding? Asphalt. And good roads, and they got them, and things didn't quite work out the way they planned.
I think also that we're interested in being a people's archive for the city, and, you know, we send people out. Archivists on staff have gone out to Occupy demonstrations, and some of the archivists from the movement have brought materials in. And if people have collections, they should contact us if they're interested.
Okay. And David, I know you're back now. You were talking a little bit about, you know, your digital or what people can see online. Did you want to?
Well, there's very little that they can see online, but we have an archive, and I have the microfilm collection from our Stanford archive that we're trying to find sponsoring some partnerships so that we can upload that microfilm collection, that is the Stanford collection, on this website at blackpanthertrust.com. That's going to be our information knowledge-based website. But in addition to that, we have about 9 hours of never-before-heard stuff by Huey Newton that was done in 1972 by the poet Gerd Stern. And so we have all of this new stuff that we're looking for some sponsoring so that we can put this stuff on a website and make it available to the public on our knowledge-based website at blackpanthertrust.com.
Very good. Well, you know, David, you have talked about throughout the show, and thank you for bringing this up, the whole social utility of history for making positive change, and you know, the effect change can, you know, the can empower people, how you can empower people with knowledge, as Dave, as I think you've said. And I guess I want to, we're getting to the top of the show, and I guess I want to talk a little bit about that from, you know, your perspectives in terms of how history, you know, whether it's in San Francisco Bay Area, can have a, people's understanding can have an impact on making positive change. Susan, let me start with you.
It depends. I think it's really important that people know the history. I think it's really important people have as much information as they can. I think it does inform social movements going forward. It can inform change, just to know what the built environment was before, the natural environment, the social landscape. I think it's essential that people know that, and that's why we need to keep collecting it.
Okay.
Yeah. Till we run out of room.
And Chris?
I mean, I think you have to really understand the social struggles and the kind of way that organizing has happened in the past, political movements, various interventions culturally and politically and in terms of labor movements and ethnic movements and everything. Because finally, you know, we're in this world. We're not in the world that any of those previous movements envisioned. And so in some ways they failed. And that's not to disparage people's hard work or the positive and hopeful visions that they embodied. But we need to learn from the things that went down in the past, because they didn't lead us to the promised land. They didn't even lead us to a bit much of a better world yet. And the world could be radically better than the one we're in. That's really the big point I always like to leave people with, is that this world that we live in today is a pale shadow of how good it could be. And everybody on the planet could live really well, if that was the point. But we rarely have that conversation. And what would it take to get there? Well, that's difficult. There's no easy, quick answer. There's not a 30-second blurb that you could just say, well, this is how you do it, blah, 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 blah. Instead, you have to actually plumb the depths of social movements that have tried so hard to erect a better world and have failed. And from that knowledge, we actually might have a chance of creating a different path out of this situation we're in today that might take us to a place that's a much better life for everyone on the earth.
Do you feel the knowledge of history really is empowerment? Or do you think that people a lot of times don't really know how to use that as empowerment?
Well, I think empowerment's a bit of a difficult concept for most people because, you know, we are fundamentally powerless as individuals in a society based on buying and selling human time, i.e. wage labor and capitalism. There's no way you're going to be powerful as an individual unless you have buckets of money. And so our power is collective. Our power is when we act together in cooperation and mutual aid and solidarity. And there are so many examples of that in our daily life today, as well as in history. And those are the things that are systematically flushed out of history books to a great extent. And that's why History from Below has been so important, because it's really brought that forward and made it much more available for people.
And Dave, thank you. And David, what about you? Quickly, I mean, I know you, actually, maybe since we are kind of short on time, maybe if you could just tell again about where people can find out and learn about the empowerment you've been talking about all along throughout the show.
Well, there's a conference that we're holding Saturday, August 25th, it's from 6 to 9 here in Vallejo at the Empress Theater. You can find out more about that by calling 517-547-1547-510.
Excellent. Well, that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Chris Carlson, San Francisco historian, tour guide, and co-founder of Critical Mass; Susan Goldstein, the city archivist of San Francisco at the San Francisco Public Library; and David Hilliard, founding member of the Black Panther Party, and currently, well, I say, as my producers...
It's the Communal Institute for Research and Social Change.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com, or go to the KLW website and you can catch us there. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Thank you so much, Debbie. And tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denmark. Thank you so much, Lisa. Great show. City Vision's senior producer is Susan Britton. And join us next week when we'll explore Title IX, the law that guarantees equal treatment for women in a federally financed education programs. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.